Now part 11 of Radio Fun, Russell Davis witnesses the birth of some of radio comedy's continuing successes during what sounds like a very fertile era.
You now have a choice of listening. You can leave the radio on or go and play a nice record. But we have a question for those who've stayed switched on. Why?
I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Ceased recording in 1973, but its influence, the patterns it established in radio comedy, stayed with us right through the 70s. And you don't have to look too hard to see them being followed even today. A team of bright young things, young initially anyway, comes freshly into the comedy business, ready-made bunch of friends, most commonly from university, and most commonly of all from Cambridge University. What they have in common is a sort of talent.
You are now about to witness an historic event. Now, I'm sorry, I'll read it again. Talent contest. So, without further ado, let's hear the first act. And now let's hear the second act. Introducing Ivor Menagerie and his singing animals. Ivor, is it true that you and these animals actually sing, you know, the actual words?
Absolutely. We sing together the actual words, that's right. Now, let me quickly introduce the group. Tonight we have a donkey. Duck. A goat?
Meh.
A horse?
Meh.
A sheep?
Meh.
A dog?
Oh!
And a chicken.
What?
Right, and we'd like to combine right now to give you a medley of popular favourites. One, two, three.
Oh.
Slow. Slow, slow. Slow.
What?
Up all cares and woe, here I go singing low.
Bah, bah.
Blackbird, because a sixpence is better than a pence is better than a farthing is better than none. And the hills are alive with the sound of we ain't got a blob. We were ragged and foon, but we'll travel along singing a song.
Somewhere among the bunch, there's usually one with a sense of responsibility, if that's what it is. It could be a sense of panic lest the whole thing falls apart. And he becomes the producer figure who tries to keep the whole thing BBC worthy.
Here is a prune flash. 16 prisoners have just broken out of Dartmoor prison.
Thank you, that was a jail warning.
Prune Flash by David Hatch, whose sense of responsibility and or panic was so well developed that he's ended up as managing director of BBC Radio. For a time, in fact, for quite some years, David Hatch combined performing in that show with the soberer task of directing BBC comedy series of completely different kinds. Comparatively straightforward adaptations, for example, like Doctor in the House, starring Richard Briers. But when I'm Sorry came to an end, the zany field was wide open again, so in stepped Hatch to direct Hello Cheeky.
Once I had a secret love.
Who was she?
She wouldn't tell me.
Didn't Doris Day sing that?
No, it was me.
It's incredible in this life. It could be her, you know.
Stand that way again.
Go. Give us another song, Doris.
I am not Doris.
Tim, come here. Who's that? Go on, who's that?
Rosemary.
No! Doris Day! I am not Doris Day!
Give us a song, Doris!
No!
Go on, Doris.
Go on, Doris. You smile, the song begins.
La, 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 la.
She's got old suddenly, hasn't she?
Oh, she's terrific for her age.
Yeah.
She's changed her hair, you know.
Tim?
Yes, Dennis?
Is that who I think it is?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I never thought I'd be playing for her.
When in my heart I know the magic in my love.
The wonderful Doris Day, ladies and gentlemen.
Yay!
Hello, Cheeky Start. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Survivor Tim Brooke Taylor with Barry Cryer and John Junkin and Dennis King at the piano. All veterans of radio. But new supplies of voices were arriving almost year by year. That was 1973. The new young chaps of 74, featuring in a show called Oh No It Isn't, were John Lloyd, later in charge of the Spitting Image Empire, and a youth known in those days under his full title of Griffith Rhys Jones.
Russian novel, so depressing. Reading one takes days and days. Anton Chekhov, less long-winded. He just wrote depressing plays. Jargon, bread, yes, in fast, he has still the digitizing brother and friendling and putting the board in. Oma Sharif in Chicago, Julie Christie loves young dreams. Someone break that balalaika, we are sick of Lara's theme. Oma Berry in the snowdrift, somewhere in Siberia. Frozen dribble in his mustache, nothing could be clearer. Stalin, Gagarin and Rimsky, Gothic of City, Moscow and Dobbs. And why don't you cross off a box in Joliet and Petrograd? Gross, Lef and Tol, Toysi, Paul. And what a
John Lloyd and Griff Rhys Jones with the sort of song that university smoking concerts had always tended to produce and still do. Just 4 years after that recording in 78, Griff Rhys Jones was himself a producer, responsible for putting on show the talents of another university-trained grotesque, Rowan Atkinson. These were the Atkinson people.
We'd like to interrupt the program at this point with a short explanation to those who are new to theatre of some of the jargon at present in common use. Let's hear that word used in a sentence.
Do you want to hear some jargon back at my place?
Jargon is a word used to describe words or phrases that have a unique meaning to a particular field of enterprise.
I have an enterprise planned for 2 o'clock.
In the world of the theatre, one of the most common of these special words is flies. Flies are the stage machinery from which items of scenery can be raised or lowered, that is, flown out or flown in. Here are some more typical uses.
I'm flying tonight. Are you? He is stuck in the flies. I'm Larry. Fly me.
For stage positioning, upstage and downstage should be self-explanatory.
I am downstage. Is that you, upstage?
Although there is a special application of the word upstage to the activity of stealing the limelight.
You upstaged me, you bastard.
And lastly, to the safety curtain that is required to appear for a minimum period during the interval of any public performance. From the material with which it is constructed, it is known as the iron.
Why isn't the iron down? I thought it was supposed to be.
Ah!
Hilda Kreisman and Rowan Atkinson among the Atkinson people. And if you don't remember them, it's probably because they were part of the small consignment of comedy that the Light Entertainment Department manages to place now and again on Radio 3. You could almost tell that by the acoustic of the recording. Emphatically not in the third programme tradition was another of the mid-70s young comedy teams, the one that was out to sell you the Berkis Way. Nobody ever worked out what the Berkis Way to dynamic living was. And Fred Harris, Chris Emmett and Joe Kendall would have been very surprised and disappointed if anyone had. An edition subtitled Make Short Comedy Programs, The Berkis Way, featured the Eurovision Raquel Welsh Gag Contest. And there's no point in wishing it didn't.
Raquel Welsh has just announced she's going in for a trial separation. Bang, ding, dong, la, la, ooh, ding-a-ling, dang, dong, bong. Provided she can find a bra strong enough. Boom, ding, dang, wong, long, dong, bong, along, ooh, la, ding-a-ding-a-dong. Thank
you, Great Britain. Ladies and gentlemen, we are very sorry that owing to great pressure, the two big favourites have dropped out.
And that was the Luxembourg entry there, which seems to have gone very well. We'll know very soon when we've got the score. Ah, is this it?
Buonasera. I decimi Roma Povera de Signorita Fasoletti e due ponte, deux points, 2 points.
And that was the Italian entry.
The Burkis way to start 1977, that was. The term alternative comedy hadn't come in yet, but another couple of waves of bright young cronies would introduce it. I don't think it's ever meant very much. Nothing very new, anyway. To me, alternative comedy is simply anything that older listeners don't like. And in that sense, it would have been perfectly applicable to the Goons in 1953. But anyway, in radio comedy, there was still plenty to be alternative to. Manchester, for example, was still serving as a beacon of broad northern pantomimic humour, with broad northern pantomimic Les Dawson one of its champions.
In those days, of course, I used to organise safaris for holidaymakers. It was my job to find animals, shoot them and have them mounted. Or if they preferred, just shaking hands. Anyway, shortly after that, whilst eating a cucumber sandwich on a high plateau, I came face to face with the most awesome life form I ever knew. The great tufted, dappled-tailed, black-infested gorilla from the Cameron Rainforest. What an animal, stood 10'6" and could chew through railings. It looked at me and I looked at it. Now, I had one bullet left in my gun, but I knew, because of all my years at Bisley, that if I fired the cave wall only 3 feet away from me, the bullet would ricochet at an angle of 2.4 on the ballistic scale, glance up a heap of hardened armadillo manure, ping off a banyan tree, and enter the gorilla's lumbar region, and render the creature halls de combat.
How exciting! Tell me, did you kill the gorilla?
No, I missed the wall.
Listen to Les, which started in 1977 and ran for 8 years. More obviously theatrical in its origins was The Enchanting World of Hinge and Bracket, which to some listeners seemed an oddity out of the Educating Archie mould. If it had been weird to have a ventriloquist operating on radio, was it any more sensible to have female impersonators going out over airwaves which gave you no chance to see the man beneath the woman, to coin a phrase? The difference really was that now we were so deeply into the television age that there could scarcely be many licensed pairs who hadn't seen Logan and Fife in action and couldn't keep their image before the mind's eye. The kind of Presbyterian purist who didn't have a television probably wouldn't be greatly taken by Hinge and Bracket anyway.
You know, I'm jolly glad I spotted you. And I'm afraid this was going to be a lonely 2 weeks, but not now, eh?
Well, don't worry. We'll be able to show you the ropes. We've done our bit, you know, on the old troop ship.
Ooh. We're certainly here, singing for our brave boys, you know.
Mind you, Hilda, I hope the conditions on this cruise are an improvement on those troop ships.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean, dear. The plumbing. Most embarrassing, all that peddling. Oh.
And the salt water showers. Do you remember it? You could never get a lather with that soap, could you?
True. 3,000 soldiers in us. Oh. Happy day.
Hinge and Bracket in the Jubilee year of 1977, which also produced a Jubilee edition from that marathon man among radio comedies, the Eternal Navy Lark, which hove to alongside the Royal Yacht.
Yes. Oh, you're the duty officer of the big blue one with the one funnel. My heart's still up. Yes. How jolly nice to see you. I'm Phillips.
No, you can't be. He's down below with HF.
Did you want something?
No. They'd like to see some seats up, catch him on the boat.
flummoxed. You mean they want us to put to sea at once?
Oh, yes.
Gosh, how thrilling. I can't wait to sail out there amongst all the home fleet in the royal yacht and navigate down the lines of... All of a sudden, I don't think I feel very well.
After not far short of two decades, the Navy Lark was still getting laughs in its 1977 Jubilee edition. But with any comedy production, there comes a time when chuckles of affection outnumber the real script-induced guffaws, hence the eventual retirement of all comedy formats. Although, news-based comedy, it's true, does have a sort of long-life guarantee built in. An endless supply of topical targets could, in theory, keep a radio satire show continually refreshed. And it certainly seems to have worked so far with the week-ending formula. Here's the 1979 team, featuring David Jason, Bill Wallace and David Tate, getting stuck into Leonid Brezhnev, President Jimmy Carter and the Salt Treaty.
No, 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 not yet, not yet. The fanfare's only for when he mentions the actual Salt Treaty. Sorry.
Sorry, Mr. Brezhnev. Sorry, Mr. Carter.
Oh, yeah.
Now, can we go through the whole ceremony just once more?
Okay, fine.
Mr. Carter's speech first.
No, no. Mine first.
No, 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 Mr. Brezhnev. Huh? We agree that if he speaks first, you can keep a bigger flag, Mr. Brezhnev. No,
and he hasn't got to sell his treaty to the Senate.
Oh, that's right, Mr. Carter.
Let us fatten up with Salt One.
No, no, not yet. Not yet. Sorry. Sorry, Mr.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, can we go straight to the fireworks, Duke? Uh-huh. Your last sentence, if you remember, it's deep fear and distress at the consequences of failure.
Okay. The deep fear and distress at the consequences of failure will be...
Now, be more rocket!
No more rockets!
That's right, Mr. Brezhnev. That's right, get the old...
But no more rockets!
Yes, that's right, Mr. Brezhnev.
Or we launch an assault.
No, just hold it. Hold it, please. We're running out of time.
Now, look, we're going to have to cut the text of the treaty.
Oh, but we can.
Well, you'll get lost in the commercial break if you don't.
Okay, now, look, take out the bit about tactical warheads.
Right, tactical. So all we need is a signing.
Not again.
Oh, look, sorry, it's only a rehearsal, isn't it? It's only a fake treaty you're signing, Mr. Brezhnev.
How did you find out?
Jimmy, everyone takes these meetings with a pinch of salt.
No, not yet!
For those who found Weekending disconcerting in its audiencelessness, the news was also placed at the mercy of a show where seriousness of comment came more obviously second to a determination to raise laughs. Roy Hudd, who has cheerfully proclaimed himself a music hall survival at heart, made his name among the satirists in a mid-60s TV show called Not So Much a Program, More a Way of Life. It wasn't till a decade later that radio had the notion of pinning on him the title of the news Hudlines.
Meanwhile, Margaret Thatcher had risen from her humble origins as a grocer's daughter to become Tory party leader. A real bags to bitches story.
Nobody can say I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. Certainly not. It has taken me 35 years to learn to talk this way.
All shows of this kind depend heavily on the ability of their casts to mimic the leaders of the day. Highly effective Thatchers have been available on radio from Janet Brown, Sally Grace, June Whitfield and Sheila Stiefel. And during the brief prime ministerial reign of Jim Callaghan, the Hudlines' Chris Emmett practically had that field to himself.
The news goes on week after week and it never seems to change, as Jim Callaghan's diary shows.
Thursday, November the 11th. Got up, had toast for breakfast. Most catastrophic day in the entire history of Britain's economy. Cut toenails, went to bed.
It had become an age as obsessed by the volume and variety of news as the wartime period had been obsessed with the importance of news. Quiz show formats, too, plundered this terrain. I remember appearing myself on the pilot program for the news quiz and thinking it was probably going to be a winner of some kind. But it's now lasted 11 years, and that I didn't foresee.
Richard Ingrams. He wants to become a millionaire at the expense of a man who may become a millionaire because of another millionaire, on the grounds that he doesn't think a mother sparrow could do what he has done with his mother, who is a frog. Who is he, Richard?
I'm trying to beat my world record of one.
You're doing very well, actually.
This week. So
my money's on you,
giving,
Richard.
I'm deliberately giving you the wrong answers, although I sometimes know the right ones.
I'm
determined to score north.
You're going to.
In the Guinness Book of Records.
Alan Corrin.
Someone has left £1 million to a sparrow's home.
And the curator of Frog's Home is disputing the word.
An early news quiz with Barry Norman in charge and Richard Ingrams and Alan Corran demonstrating two ways of not knowing the answer. Over the last decade, there have come to be panel games of every conceivable kind, and a few inconceivable ones too. It's a policy with shows of that kind to over-record by a few minutes and then cut out the embarrassing bits, where possible. This applied even to that brilliantly misbegotten idiocy, I'm sorry I haven't a clue, the antidote to panel games, chiefly because here the participants, guided or goaded by Humphrey Lyttelton, were operating for some of the time quite near the outer limits of what improvisation can achieve. But near the end of the show, they were allowed to relax into something a little more prepared, the gag-crackers ball of the intellectual set.
Well, this is the time in the programme when I tiptoe away to the computer room at the BBC to work out the final score for the entire series. Meanwhile, the teams will give us their announcements for the late arrivals at the pharmacist's ball. Who's going to start?
Welcome, please, the distinguished Irish actor, T.C.P. McKenna. The Oviraforms with a hideously bound child in terror Oviraforms. Will you welcome, please, Mr. and Mrs. Tuff and their mama Tuff.
Welcome, please, Mr. and Mrs. Royd and their daughter Emma. A warm hand and a brown paper bag, please. Mr. and Mrs. Tick and their daughter Emma Tick. makes me sick. Cabaret time, ladies and gentlemen. If I can get away with it. We welcome, please, Prin the Dissolving Donkey. Known as, I will.
You will.
Known as Soluble Ash Prin.
Yes! Not everybody listening could go along with something as wildly anarchic as that show seemed to be when it started up. But for enthusiasts of traditional comedy drama, relief was available from one of the great pairings in radio casting. The end of each playlist involved them in memorable sortings out of the denouement.
It couldn't have been more than a week later when Jeeves, after he had brought me my tea, gently steered me away from the sporting page of the Morning Post to direct my attention to an announcement in the engagements and marriages column.
The marriage has been arranged and will shortly take place between the Honourable and Reverend Hubert Wingham, third son of the Right Honourable the Earl of Sturridge, and Mary, only daughter of the late Matthew Burgess of Weatherly Court, hence. Well, of course, I expected this, Jeeves.
Yes, sir.
She would never forgive him for what happened that night.
No, sir.
Well, I don't suppose it'll take old Bingo long to get over it. It's about the 111th time this sort of thing has happened to him. You're the man I'm sorry for.
Me, sir?
Well, dash it all, Jeeves. You can't have forgotten what a deuce of a lot of trouble you took to bring the thing off for Bingo. It's too bad that all your work should have been wasted.
Not entirely wasted, sir.
What?
It is true that my efforts to bring about the match between Mr. Little and the young lady were not successful, but I still look back upon the matter with a certain satisfaction.
Oh, because you did your best, you mean?
Not entirely, sir. Though, of course, that thought also gives me pleasure. I was alluding more particularly to the fact that I found the affair financially remunerative.
Financially what do you mean?
When I learned that Mr. Steggles had interested himself in the contest, sir, I went shares with my friend Brookfield and bought the book which had been made on the issue by the landlord of the Cow and Horses. It has proved a highly profitable investment. Your breakfast will be ready almost immediately, sir. Kidneys on toast and mushrooms. I will bring it when you ring.
Thank you, Jeeves.
Richard Briers and Michael, later Sir Michael, and jolly well deserved too, Horden in What Ho, Jeeves. As for the reach of the imagination into more alien terrains, not much had been done about interstellar travel on radio since the 1950s cliffhanger Journey into Space, which was itself a light entertainment production. But as the 70s was the decade which saw real space flight occurring on a regular basis, it was little wonder that radio comedy went into orbit too. The first show to achieve liftoff was not the one I suspect you're thinking of, but a slightly more rickety vehicle, manned by David Jason, Nigel Lambert, and Chris Langham, and titled It Was on the Spaceship Venus.
Ah, we're gaining on him.
This old crate won't keep this feed up for long, sir.
Then we'll have to stop him, but how?
I know, sir. We could humour him.
Humour him? What do you mean?
Well, this ship is equipped with joke rays.
Yeah?
No one can resist a joke.
Do you think it'll work?
Well, this ship's pretty old, so the jokes will be dated, but it's still worth a try, sir.
But see if we can get him with the weaker ones.
We'll certainly have to go very carefully. There's a danger of this degenerating into fart.
Okay, fart. I just hope you know what you're doing.
I think so, sir. The basic idea is that if we fire enough lousy jokes at Zeren's ship, awful cracks will appear all over the hull.
Good. Fire away then, Sergeant.
We'd better not use our sophisticated stuff. They'll go right over his head. Yeah. Well, let's have a look. I'll try this one, sir. What do you get when you cross a lump of moon rock with a pair of trousers? I'll give that time to sink in. Now, fire!
Pantaloons! Oh, that was horrible. You'll have to do better than that.
And better than that was done, quite soon, by the space comedy I know I was thinking of. Douglas Adams was one of the several 1970s comedy talents who came out of university performing and writing into a producer's job in BBC Light Entertainment, and then out into writing again. The show that made Adams his name was a strange and appealing cross between a drama and a book at bedtime, a book that read itself, really, in the unforgettable tones of a man who'd been a master of radio voices since right back in the early 50s. The choice of Peter Jones was inspired.
This is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Perhaps the most remarkable, certainly the most successful book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor. More popular than the Celestial Home Care Omnibus, better selling than 53 More Things to Do in Zero Gravity, and more controversial than Ulan Khalifid's trilogy of philosophical blockbusters, Where God Went Wrong, Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes, and Who Is This God Person Anyway?
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy had a quality of finishedness about it, as though nothing could, let alone should, have been different, that is rare in radio comedy, outside classic adaptations of the P.G. Woodhouse kind that we've heard. It's a matter of inventing your own idiom and operating surely within it, which Woodhouse himself did, the Goons, for example, had done, and now Douglas Adams was doing.
Night's falling. Look, robot, the stars are coming out.
I know. Wretched, isn't it?
But that sunset, I've never seen anything like it in my wildest dreams. The two suns, it was like mountains of fire boiling into space.
I've seen it, it's rubbish.
We only ever had the one sun at home. I came from a planet called Earth, you know.
I know, you keep going on about it, it sounds awful.
Oh no, it was a beautiful place.
Did it have oceans?
Oh yes. Great, wide, rolling blue oceans.
Can't bear oceans.
Tell me, do you get on well with other robots?
Hate them. Where are you going?
I think I'll just take a short...
Don't blame you.
Good evening. You choose a cold night to visit our dead planet? My name is not important. Do not be alarmed. I will not harm you.
But you shot at us through a missile.
Merely an automatic system. Ancient computers, ranged in the long caves deep in the bowels of the planet, tick away the dark millennia. I think they take the occasional pot shot to relieve the monotony. I'm a great fan of science, you know.
Really?
Oh, yes. You seem ill at ease.
Well, no disrespect, but I gathered you were all dead.
Dead? No. We have but slept.
Oh, slept?
Yes, through the economic recession, you see.
What?
Well, 5 million years ago, the galactic economy collapsed, and seeing that custom-built planets are something of a luxury commodity, you see, you know we built planets, do you?
Yes, I sort of gathered.
Fascinating, Drake. Doing the coastlines was always my favorite. Used to have endless fun doing all of the...
Simon Jones, Stephen Moore, and Richard Vernon. Like all the best nonsense, Hitchhiker's Guide went its way with an almost infuriating calm. But not so the rest of modern radio comedy, which we'll be bringing up to date, and even beyond, appropriately enough, next time. Meanwhile, a message from the office of the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Are you a nudist, teetotal, retired brigadier with £25,000 income, one child, and a bicycle, who's living in sin with a war widow? No? Oh well, better luck next budget.
Radio Fun was written and presented by Russell Davis and produced by Neil Cargill. Radio Fun was written and presented by Russell Davis and produced by Neil Cargill.